Welcome you all to the Third District Court of Appeals. We are here this morning to hear one case. We'll go ahead and get ready announcements and jump right in. Court will call Robert Henneke versus Texas Department of Public Safety, cause number 18263CV. Can we have announcements, please?
David Gonzalez for Mr. Henneke.
Morning, Mr. Gonzalez.
Good morning.
Kevin Givens for the Department of Public Safety.
Good morning, Mr. Givens. For those of you new to the Third Court, which I don't think either of you are, each side is allocated 20 minutes to argue the case. I assume that you have gotten with our clerk to allocate how much time you want to hold back for rebuttal. We have a time warning system with lights. When the yellow light comes on, you have 2 minutes. When the red light comes on, you're out of time and need to look for the court to continue on. And by way of housekeeping, if anyone in the audience has a cell phone, pager, other device, now would be the time to turn it off. And finally, we recently installed an audio recording system, and so the case will be audio recorded. You'll be able to go on the court's website after the fact and pull the audio transcript. And so keep that in mind as well. With that, we will hear from the attorneys. Mr. Gonzalez.
Thank you, and may it please the court. The most important evidence in this case, the only objective evidence, the only probative evidence, was Mr. Henneke's blood alcohol content of 0.041. And obtaining this scientific evidence is the entire bedrock for the implied consent statute of which they defend. And so it's not without irony that when the department objects to their own evidence, and when the ALJ ignores that evidence in the order, we have concerns about the arbitrariness and the capriciousness of the decision. Our belief is that Mr. Henneke has three avenues for relief in this case. The first is that when the ALJ ignores reliable and probative evidence, this court can disregard that opinion. Second, this is where the Salinas issue comes in. We think that the ALJ substituted a claim of privilege with probative evidence. And after Salinas, this is going to be, I think, more troubling when you must expressly invoke that right. And the third issue is that in an alcohol-only case, when there's no evidence of any other intoxicant or drugs, in an alcohol-only case, evidence of a 0.04 must be considered no probable cause as a matter of law based upon how our statutes are written. Because otherwise, it's an enterprise on building on shifting sands, that if you're under an 0.04, then we change it to loss of normal use.
Well, is that for this court to do away with the loss of faculties manner of proof? And what about the decisions that say the offense is still the same, it's just two means for proving evidence, or for proving the singular offense?
Perhaps this court can't do away with that in all the other cases, except the limited band of those cases where we're determining probable cause in an ALR hearing, and we have evidence of a 0.04. And so in that situation, I'd say under these limited facts, when someone presents evidence of an 0.04, and it's dispositive, and it's uncontroverted that it's accurate, how can we then shift to loss of normal use on a de novo review of whether there was probable cause, which is the whole idea of the ALJ?
Well, and the probable cause isn't to prove the offense in and of itself. The probable cause question is to determine whether or not the officer had the belief that the offense had been committed.
That's right. And I think since Ornelas, in many cases that talk about how probable cause is a mixed question of fact and law, we give de novo review for this exact reason. And our hope was that the ALJ would have given the same de novo review to what the officer says. And ever since Castigar, in a number of cases, we don't just take what the officer says as honest or truthful. If we have independent evidence like the video or some other probative evidence like scientific evidence to say it disputes what your conclusions were. And I think this does raise the question, Justice Gordon, is probable cause at an 08? Or can you say there's probable cause because he was at an 04, so that's good enough in hindsight? And I think that's the problem.
Is it part of the problem, though, that the probable cause is being made, determinations being made on the spot, and then the testing ends up being hindsight? I mean, the officer doesn't have the benefit of the test.
You're right, but the ALJ did. And I think that's the problem that we have.
And I think that if the ALJ would have not admitted the evidence of 0.04, but they did, correct?
She did.
I mean, so this is we've got a good stop. We've got
eventual arrest for DWI. We've got the DIC 24 being read, and so this really is just about that one refusal question, isn't it? It's not about, well, I'll get back to that.
Well, if I can take that and start with that, it's one of the issues. You're right. We think when you look at what's being weighed, our concern is that the refusal after Salinas now gets weighed with the same probative force. Actually, I think more probative force, because we don't even have the 04 in the order. It'd be one thing if she said, I've looked at the 04, and I don't think it's as reliable as this, 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 and that, and the invocation is what really bothers me. But that's not what happens. She indicates his invocation of the Fifth Amendment right as a factor, and I think after Salinas, we're stuck.
Is that a sufficiency question, though? Is that where the UDJA comes in? And I mean, how often do courts do a UDJA on the relative probative value of a piece of evidence?
Well, I think under Rule 513C, we talk a lot about how much inference do we give in civil cases when someone invokes the Fifth Amendment. So we know it's happening a lot. And I think this question is basically now a constitutional one, where what weight can you give an invocation? And the second issue which you raise is, well, now you've got all these other mixed questions about the probative value, and the order says he was standing sure-footed, he's articulate, he's smart, he invokes consistently. What kind of deference do we give these kind of orders? And I think ever since from the city of Dallas versus Stewart to the hospital, the Dallas case, when an ALJ writes a 40-page opinion with 300 facts, I think this court is free to give very, very good deference to that. But I think the Supreme Court in Texas has often been hesitant to say if you've got just a summary or a recitation of facts and there's no actual chewing on it or weighing on it, it's harder to give that deference. And that's one of our concerns that I think leads this issue. On that related note to Salinas, the reason we keep going back to where we think this might happen again and again, we're just in a bind. Because if I am faced with a guilt-presumptive APD officer who at the get is starting to ask questions that aren't designed to provoke anything other than just an incriminating response, if I'm silent after Salinas, that gets used against me. If I talk, well, then I've waived my Fifth Amendment after Salinas. If I invoke, then that gets used against me. And I think I don't know what an innocent person does. Because if we look at what the progeny of the Supreme Court's always said is we do not want to penalize, and nor can we penalize, the invocation. From police officers in Garrity hearings to lawyers saying that I'm not going to be able to give you evidence incriminating against myself, we've allowed at most a negative inference, but this is beyond a negative inference. This is, first of all, finding a conclusion of, I think, a fact in a law.
Assuming that inference was taken by the ALJ and that a court determined that that was improper, is there enough else here, though, in this factual record to justify probable cause based upon the officer's observations, his observation of slurred speech, bloodshot eyes, the things that you see generally in these cases? Because it seemed like the record reads like a lot of other cases, with the exception of this relatively fascinating Fifth Amendment issue.
And if I might also add, the .04. Because the cases cited by the department are all 161s, and these cases were, I think, under kind of hindsight bias, when you get in evidence the 17 or the 14 or the 13, when you do the search warrant and it comes up with a trunk full of cocaine, it seems to justify the probable cause and the inception. This is a different case in which now a neutral magistrate can look and say, maybe all the slurred speech that you're saying wasn't so slurry. Maybe the arguments that you're saying about the odor, maybe I can discount that. And I think that's what presents this case, because I disagree. I don't think there's evidence of probable cause. This was introduced both at the ALJ and the county court. The video is, I think, the best evidence. And I don't see the driving facts the same way that the officer reported. I don't see the speech as slurred. I don't see anything confused. I don't see mumbling. And I'm not trying to reweigh the evidence. I'm just concerned that none of this evidence is in this one-page order.
Do we have that?
I would say, Mr. Gonzalez.
Because, I mean, I see a picture of the CD, and that drives me bonkers.
We've asked for the video, but if you would help the clerk make sure they get that to us, that would be great. We do not have the video.
I'm sorry that you've got a picture. It's probably hard to play.
Yeah, El Paso never had it, and so when they transferred it to us, we never got it.
Done. It'll be done today.
Let me ask you a question about the findings. One thing that concerns me about the case is I don't see how the Fifth Amendment issue is really teed up based on the findings. I mean, her findings, when I read the brief, I thought, okay, we've got this issue here where the ALJ is actually saying refusal to, you know, answer questions was the problem, but she really just says he was uncooperative, polite, and cocky. I've never seen those two words together, but still, uncooperative, polite, and cocky, and his balance was sure, and then says he also refused to participate in field sobriety tests, asserting his Fifth Amendment constitutional rights. So do we really have the issue of not answering the officer's questions as being cited against Mr. Haneke?
Not based on, if you look at the text of her order versus what the evidence is and what the actual DVD shows, the invocation was in response to questioning about how much he had to drink and where he was coming from. The officer concluded that his invocation was a refusal to do everything else. And so that's my concern, is once he invokes during the interrogation portion, the ALJ takes it as, well, that's a refusal. And I think invocations and refusals are very different after Salinas. Silence and refusals are one thing and can be used against you. Invocations cannot, and I think...
But had he invoked the Fifth on the field sobriety test as well?
Well, he invoked at the time where he's not even out of the car yet, and the questioning is being a bit more pressured about your lying. He's assuming you're lying to me. Where are you coming from? Work. What time do you get off work? And it was getting hostile, and I think my concern kind of in the doctrine of unclean hands is, had this officer handled things differently, we'd be in a very different situation. But I have trouble when an officer deliberately is confrontational and then gets to penalize him for invoking his rights, saying, I don't want to get into a fight with you. Like, this is not going to go well. Let me just invoke.
Well, so where's the error? I'm looking at the administrative decision. Where is the error in that?
In that last sentence, that she's relying upon his invocation of his Fifth Amendment as a refusal?
Well, it just says defendant refused to participate in any field sobriety test
asserting his Fifth Amendment rights.
Constitutional right.
So I would say that, number one, equating an invocation of rights as some sort of probative evidence of refusal is my first concern. Because after Salinas, if he doesn't invoke it, he loses it. So now he's in a bind. If he just says silence and says, I don't want to do them, I think that gets used against him under Salinas.
But there's a lot of case law around the state right now saying that there is no Fifth Amendment privilege with regard to field sobriety tests.
Agreed.
Okay.
And so this is... And
that's
not
your position.
I'd say because those are non-testimonial, right? All those right. Issues are, that, you know, just like doing the alphabet or a specimen test are non-testimonial. But he was invoking during the testimonial phase of this interrogation is the first issue. Second is, let's say after Salinas, even if he does invoke, I still think we can't treat it the same after Salinas as a refusal, because I think all those cases that talked about that are all pre-Salinas, and I think we're in a different ballgame. Salinas is an odd case, and I understand the facts of Salinas are so weird, where one question in a Salinas also was non-custodial. He wasn't under arrest and he wasn't Mirandized. So he's in the same footing as Salinas when he's talking. So if he's in the same footing as Salinas and he doesn't say, I don't want to answer these questions, that gets used against him. If he says, I'm refusing to do field sobriety tests, that used against him. I think after Salinas, we're now in this kind of problem where if he does say, well, I'm going to invoke my Fifth, I have concerns that gets used against him. And even if it can, and if this court says, well, it can, I also have concerns that it has probative value, because your court, as well as the Supreme Court, have said, like, for example, in a motion for summary judgment, a party invoking the Fifth through all the depositions is not evidence to support a summary judgment motion. At most, it's an inference, and even then, it's not, under 513C, a mandatory inference. Evidence and inferences are different, and invocations and evidences are different. And I guess my concern, when you have this laundry list of contradictory facts, and then throw in, by the way, he invoked, I think we're seeing a lot of problems on roadside encounters for this reason. And my concern is that we tell people, don't fight with the police when it's a tense situation. We don't want that. And he does everything right to de-escalate it, and the officer keeps trying to escalate it time and time again. And then he gets penalized at the ALR, saying, well, because you chose to de-escalate the situation and invoke your rights, that's another grounds for why we think you're impaired. And then as to the issue about...
No, they didn't. No, and that's an important distinction. The ALR judge did not say, we think you are impaired. I think the conclusion is the ALR judge determined that the officer had a belief that there was probable cause to arrest for DWI. And what the proof is going to show later was a whole other issue.
Well, so I guess I look at like Florida versus Bostick and Florida versus Ryder, and the idea that if I ask for your consent to search your house and you tell me no, do I get a warrant on that refusal? But like DWI carries this whole new kind of odd world. Well, the refusal, we can think that maybe you're hiding something. And nowhere else, if I ask to search your purse or your backpack or your house and you refuse, the invocation of your rights can't be used as evidence. But here it does. And even if we say it's not really being used, I think it is. I think it's happening a lot. And I just see a lot more problems with people after Salinas when people said, well, you've got to invoke or you lose it. In these situations where I don't think folks are going to be as sophisticated or as eloquent or as articulate as Mr. Henneke is, but he does everything correctly. And as it relates to the last issue, and we can talk more about this in rebuttal on vagueness, going to the issue that you said you wanted to address later about the 0.08 standard and probable cause for loss of use, of normal use, there's certainly nothing in the judgment that discusses loss of any physical or mental faculties. If his balance is sure footing, it's hard to confuse consumption of alcohol like odor with some sort of physical manifestations, and likewise mentally, he's fine. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. Mr. Givens.
May it please the court. I think there's a fundamental issue that we have to deal with at the very outset of this case, which is the belief that a person having a 0.04 alcohol concentration at some unknown point in time is probative evidence, and in fact definitive evidence, that the person is not intoxicated at a different point in time. And that simply is not the law. And in order for a person to be intoxicated in Texas, a person doesn't have to have any specific blood alcohol concentration. And in fact, if a person has any specific blood alcohol concentration, that doesn't prohibit them from being deemed intoxicated under Texas law. Even if the 0.04 was an accurate representation of the defendant's alcohol concentration at the time of his arrest, that would not prevent a finding that he had lost the normal use of his mental and physical faculties. And because of that, the officer certainly could have had probable cause to believe that the defendant was intoxicated regardless of the alcohol concentration. And again, assuming that the alcohol concentration was in fact probative. We don't know if it's probative because we don't know when it was taken. It could have been taken the next day. There's absolutely no evidence in the record to show when that alcohol concentration test was taken. Furthermore, the ALJ did not ignore probative evidence. The ALJ simply gave no weight to this evidence, found that it was not probative. The idea that, the second point, as to whether or not Salinas, the ALJ was substituting that invocation as probative evidence, well, that invocation is probative evidence. This court has specifically found in the Adair case that the invocation is evidence that can be used against a person when it is pre-arrest and pre-Miranda, as was this case. Roadside questioning is not subject to Fifth Amendment protections. So a person who invokes their right to silence at that time, that right does not attach at that moment. And so, as this court has specifically stated, the invocation of the Fifth Amendment does not prohibit the use of introducing the defendant's silence as probative evidence of guilt. Finally, the idea.
And has that changed at all since Salinas? Is there any difference between silence versus affirmatively invoking your Fifth Amendment?
I don't believe so. I think, I mean, in fact, the Salinas case that went up on appeal, the Court of Criminal Appeals specifically stated in that case that pre-arrest, pre-Miranda silence is not protected. And in fact, the You know, the United States Supreme Court in that case, if you look at footnote 3 of the Salinas opinion, and if you look at what Justice Alito said, that there's this misconception that the Fifth Amendment has this universal absolute right to silence, and that's simply not true. And in footnote 3 of the court's opinion, they specifically say that the right to silence under the Fifth Amendment does not apply to pre-Miranda silence. So
this whole area of the law kind of meets itself coming and going in some ways. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court, decades ago, there was a case called Spivak that it was a lawyer in disbarment proceedings that refused to respond to a subpoena from the state bar based on and asserted his Fifth Amendment privilege, and the Supreme Court turned around the disbarment, which was based on the invocation of the Fifth Amendment privilege. I mean, it's purely a civil proceeding. No, how's that different? How's that different here?
Well, I think that without knowing the specific facts of the case, I think there in Salinas, it lays out a couple of different instances where the invocation of the Fifth Amendment right is extended beyond what the court holds in Salinas. And so I think that that's probably one of those instances. But again, I don't know the specific facts of that case and how they would relate to this one.
Now, what do we do with the interesting part of this case in some ways, or difficult part of this case, is you've got all this criminal law and Fifth Amendment invocation of the privilege, but we're in an administrative proceeding subject to the APA. So what do we do with, I mean, I've always wondered this, and we've not had this issue really come up since I've been on the court that I'm aware of. Yeah, the 2001-174, the standard for substantial evidence review, A, says if there's any finding, conclusion, or decision in violation of a constitutional or statutory provision, we have to reverse. It says you shall reverse. What do we do with that? Because I know you're making the arguments under E that we look at, you know, the traditional substantial evidence review, that if we find a scintilla of evidence, we have to affirm the agency decision. But what do we do if, assuming we found a constitutional violation, just assuming that hypothetically, what do we do? Does that mean we actually do have to reverse?
Assuming that the second part of that, though, is that you have to find that that constitutional violation substantially or affected the substantial rights of the appellant. In this particular case, and this is getting back to a point that was raised earlier, if you look at this case and you say, even if there was a constitutional violation by considering his refusal to do field sobriety tests as part of the evidence, there's still probable cause in this case to arrest him based on the driving, the slurred speech, the glassy eyes, those things all together, I think, would constitute probable cause. And so I believe that there's, because of that second prong that you have to find.
We still wrap around and look at the evidence to see if there's enough evidence, if you took away the constitutional violation, if there's enough evidence to proceed.
Exactly.
How do we evaluate that evidence in a record like this, though, where the officer was so fixated and obviously aggravated by the fact that he refused to answer questions? I mean, this officer just went straight to the fact that he refused to answer and basically admitted that that was one of the deciding factors as to why he found probable cause.
Well, and I think that may be part of his decision, but the actual analysis of probable cause is an objective one. So the ALJ has to look at those facts and determine whether or not there was probable cause objectively, not whether or not the officer believed that there was probable cause. I know in the record, in the video that you'll see later, the officer says, I believe I have probable cause. Well, whether the officer believes he has probable cause or not isn't really a factor. It's not a determining factor about whether, in fact, there was probable cause. So the ALJ has to look at the facts that are presented, and even though the officer is clearly agitated and wants the defendant to answer his questions, that doesn't mean that there's not probable cause or that there is probable cause, you know, what the officer's opinion doesn't really decide that case.
Well, but aren't those facts based in large part on that officer's perceptions and opinion? For example, slurred speech, glassy eyes. That's that same officer.
Right, and that's a question of credibility. If you look at this and you say the officer has these opinions that are informed by the defendant's refusal to answer questions or refusal to do field sobriety tests, that's a question of credibility, and that's a question that has to be determined by the ALJ. It's not for the county court at law, and it's not for this court to decide either. The last thing that I want to point out is the idea that someone having a .04, that we can retroactively go back and determine that there was no probable cause, is contrary to all of our law. The idea that we can base probable cause on something that we discover after the arrest is simply not countenanced by any of our case law. We have to decide based on the facts as they are known at the time whether or not there was probable cause. And so, and again,
was this, well, like a Frank's determination.
Pardon me? I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, don't worry.
That's
who's Frank?
If somebody misrepresents something that is contained within the probable cause affidavit and went to the decision-making process of the determination of probable cause, and you find out later that that's just not the case, then that can go back, and you take that evidence out, and then you have to look at the rest of the probable cause affidavit in the absence of that evidence to see, is there still probable cause? You can go back and do that.
Certainly, but that's, I think, if I understand you correctly, you're talking about someone who has misrepresented a fact.
That we can never go back and look at probable cause in hindsight, and yeah, we can.
Okay, we
can.
Yeah, under those circumstances, I would agree with that then.
And I mean, I think a .04 is certainly evidence, it's probative of something. It's certainly prejudicial, that's why you objected to it, right?
Well, we objected to it because it's, again, there's no indication of when this blood sample was taken. So it is. I would question the relevance of it at all.
Wasn't it taken by the department? Or
it was taken by
after
the
after a warrant.
After a warrant.
A warrant was issued.
Yes,
but
yes,
there wasn't
it was.
Any sort of timestamp or
and
documentation.
That warrant was
but we
issued.
Don't have that in the record.
And that warrant was issued on the basis of?
Of the probable cause that the officer. but again, the officer's observations at that time. And again, the other point that we want to make clear here is that a person can be intoxicated, going back to my very first point, a person can be intoxicated at .04. I mean, if you even look back at the authority cited by Justice Scalia in that dissenting opinion, a person can be intoxicated at a .04. So even if you go back and you have this sort of way back machine, the fact that the person was a .04 doesn't mean that they were not intoxicated. And again, our burden here is not to prove that the defendant was in fact intoxicated, only to prove that there was probable cause to believe that he was.
Is it DPS's position that a person could actually blood test at 0.0? And you know, I'm just trying to think of the hypothetical. I guess someone could have someone in their vehicle who had been drinking, drops them off, so there's still the smell of alcohol, they're tired, so they have red eyes. You know, is it the position of DPS that the blood alcohol test results don't matter at all?
I'm not saying that they don't matter at all. I'm saying that they do not, as a matter of law, reverse that determination of probable cause. Even if they were a 0.0, again, you look at probable cause based on the facts that are known to the officer at the time. And assuming that there's no misrepresentation, then there's no reason to go beyond the facts that are known to the officer at the time. If it turns out that, and there is case law from this court talking about the fact that if exculpatory evidence later comes out that it doesn't negate reasonable suspicion, and I think the same rule applies to probable cause. If exculpatory evidence comes out later and determines as a matter of law that you were not intoxicated, that doesn't negate a finding of reasonable suspicion or probable cause at the time.
So in some ways, you know, there may be a public policy problem with taking someone's person's license away. It's had nothing to drink. But what you're saying is, under the framework we have to look at, that's not our call. I mean, not our call anyway, I guess, on a public policy matter. But as long as there's probable cause in that officer's mind, you're saying we have to affirm.
I believe, in a reasonable officer's mind. And again, objective. Getting back to that objective standard, but yes, that's correct.
So the only time, I mean, I'm trying to envision how this would work in my practice before. The only time this would come up is if the officer was being unreasonable and lacked credibility, if they're saying under similar facts. I don't understand.
I think that's correct. I think if the officer, if the facts showed.
The officer says, I believe I had probable cause, and unless he's just absolutely incredible. Or uncredible. That's it?
I believe that that's correct.
It seems like we're just setting people up for, you know, if the officer pulls you over and has anything they can articulate that says you might have been drinking, then you're going to lose your license.
If you refuse.
And I think that is the policy that the legislature attempted to enact here. The legislature wants people to provide a specimen voluntarily, and so they created this this statutory scheme.
I don't think that the legislature has set up a policy for people who have not had a drop of alcohol to have to just pull over because, or, you know, they've been speeding. So there's reasonable suspicion. We got that. The stop is good, but then they have to subject themselves to a breathalyzer just because DPS says so.
Well, there has to be probable cause to believe that they were intoxicated.
Sure.
And so that's the point. That's the whole issue here is whether there was probable cause to believe that the person was intoxicated.
But if
there wasn't,
refusing to take the test can go towards that probable cause.
Pardon me?
Refusing to take the test can go towards that probable cause.
It can go toward the
exercising your Fifth Amendment right.
Refusing to take field sobriety test can go toward the probable cause. Refusing to take the test itself can be evidence used at trial for the DWI, but that the refusal to take the test is an element that we have to prove in this case. It's not part of the evidence of the probable cause analysis. So there again, the protection that the legislature envisioned is that there must be probable cause. And you can decide whether or not a person is credible, whether or not an officer is credible, based on the fact that a person later turns out to have no alcohol in their system. That is certainly something that the administrative judge could decide. Again, the question of credibility is for the administrative law judge. And so the administrative law judge, if the results came back as a 0-0, the administrative law judge could look at those results and look at the officer's testimony and decide that the officer wasn't credible at that point in time. But if the ALJ looks at the results and says they're a 0-0, but we don't know when the results came from, and we don't know anything more about the stop itself and the arrest other than what the officer has said, and if everything else on the tape matches what the officer says, like for instance the slurred speech, we can't see the glossy eyes, but we can't see all of the driving because it only picks up after he's made the turn, and so you don't see him weaving as he's coming toward the officer. You only see the last one as he's already made the turn. So
can I ask another question? Do you know what subpoena was refused? Which was the subpoena that was refused? Because we keep talking about how we don't know when the test was taken. And I know that there was a subpoena in there that was refused Mr. Gonzalez's client. Do you know what subpoena that was?
I'm not sure.
On
that point, though, I want to go one last thing about the idea that the refusal can be used as probative evidence, but in a search situation, it would not be allowed to be used as evidence in order to get a warrant. The difference here is that the idea of a search is protected by the Fourth Amendment. However, non-testimonial evidence, such as field sobriety tests, are not protected by the Fifth Amendment. That's why the refusal to do field sobriety tests can be probative evidence, whereas a refusal to allow someone to search is not admissible as probative evidence in order to get a warrant. So there's a very substantial distinction there between Fifth Amendment coverage of non-testimonial evidence and Fourth Amendment refusal to grant a voluntary determination to grant a search. So that's the last thing that I had. If the court has no other questions, then I'll yield it back.
Thank you, Mr. Givens. Mr. Gonzalez?
I have 4 points in rebuttal. First, I'm troubled by the view of judicial review or the lack thereof, because from both Delaware versus Franks, as well as from Ornelas in 1996, in Ornelas versus the United States, Justice Rehnquist analyzed a case from the Seventh Circuit by Posner. And questions of reasonable suspicion to stop and probable cause should always be reviewed de novo. Both Rehnquist and Posner said, articulating precisely what reasonable suspicion and probable cause means is not possible. We have never expressly deferred to trial court's determination. I'm hard-pressed to think they then deferred uniquely just to a law enforcement officer's determination of probable cause, and no one else can review that. So I think that's been very clear. And this Supreme in Texas, in City of Dallas versus Stewart, Justice Wallace Jefferson had opined that when you've got a constitutional fact, it's always de novo as well, and we don't just substitute what the officer says is probable cause.
So you're saying that it circumvents the APA here?
I think so. I think the great thing about City of Dallas, as well as the other case involving Dallas Hospital, related to the substantial evidence standard, is I think in Texas Healthcare Facilities versus Charter Medical Dallas, the Supreme Court said, in this case, the commission gives us almost 500 findings of fact covering approximately 48 pages. In that situation, they gave deference because it was so significant. But in City of Dallas, the court revisited that, and the Supreme Court said, but we're not going to give deference to this opinion because it involves a constitutional fact, and that's what we're here for. Second, thank you for your pronunciation of Spivak versus Klein.
I have no idea if it's correct.
I'll take it, because it's not just Spivak, but it's also Baxter versus Palmigiano, that a silence is not sufficient to support an adverse decision by the disciplinary board. In Rylander, the claim of privilege is not a substitute for evidence. In Garrity, in Gardner, in Lefkowitz, I mean, case after case from the Supreme Court on invocation has said repeatedly, you cannot, it's a right for a reason, and we have concerns that invoking your rights and then holding it against you destroy the entire idea of your rights to begin with. And what was interesting, too, in one of the opinions is discussing kind of how you weigh these. And so I thought it was helpful to break it down. And the way they did is they said, first, at most, invocation is a negative inference under 513C. Any negative inference can't arise more than beyond mere suspicion. And mere suspicion is less than a scintilla of evidence. And that's from King Ranch. So if that's the kind of bailiwick we're at, my concern when the department says, no, you get to use as evidence and you can't stop that, is it's contrary to everything both the Supreme Court in Texas has said as well. Third, if the evidence in this case was the BAC was a 144, I guarantee they'd be saying how probative it was. And this is the concern I have about the vagueness of the statute, that it goes both ways. This is why people distrust the system, because if the evidence is clear that it's an 04, we say, well, that doesn't matter, it's loss of normal use. But when the statute says, and I think this is my issue, if the statute says a .08 is a presumption of intoxication, then I think he's right. But when the statute says you're intoxicated at 08, the legislature has put us in this bind. Because I think if you're 06, 05, 04, by the definition, you are not intoxicated. And I don't think the state, under both the rule of lenity or any other rule you want, gets to then switch and say, well, even though the definition is clear, we're going to switch to loss of normal use. And even if people at an 04 may be impaired, then that language needs to be changed by the legislature to talk about presumptions and not definitions. But the way it's written now, it puts us, for those that either don't take a test or say, I'll do it and it's a 0.01, well, I still think it's loss of normal use. Otherwise, it gives that statute not only no meaning, but I think it causes huge harm in terms of the vagueness where we can't then rely upon that. And I think it undermines legitimacy when people say, I blew an 04 and I still got arrested. When lawyers tell you don't take the test, that's why. This makes no sense. I thought if I was under 08, I wouldn't be prosecuted or I wouldn't be arrested. The last issue is related to, I think, just generally about concerns
of
practice.
Can we strike down a criminal statute in a civil case? I know the answer.
I'd like to. I don't see, I probably haven't raised it ripe in this case because he wasn't prosecuted, and so I don't think I've given you a good vehicle to do so. I certainly would like to do so in relates to the ALR opinions, Your Honor. Thank you so much for your audience this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. Mr. Givens, fine arguments on an interesting case. The case will be submitted and the court will stand at recess. Thank you all.